Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Best Ever You Show with your host, Elizabeth Hamilton Garino, CEO and founder of the Best Ever You Network. The Best Ever You Show is here to help you live your life to the fullest. How? Real people, including celebrities, real advice, real places, products and businesses, real life stories. With this radio show, printed magazine, websites, community, and more. And now, here is your host, Elizabeth.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Hello, hello, hello. Thank you for joining us today on the Best Ever You Show. We're so happy that you're here with us. We have a wonderful guest. We have Luann Robinson-Hull with us today. And before we get to Luann, I just want to take a moment and thank everyone at Blog Talk Radio. Our show is featured under Staff Picks. You can hear Luann. Hi, Luann. We can hear you back there. Our show is featured on Staff Picks today. Luann's beautiful face and all the information about her book and everything happy is up on Blog Talk Radio right there under Staff Picks on the homepage. You can go to blogtalkradio.com. And then also, just a little housekeeping here, I just wanted to let you know we're up on iTunes and we are getting just so much feedback that it's incredible. But you can listen to our show for free, download it from iTunes. It's the Best Ever You Show. My co-host on Tuesdays is Dr. Katie Eastman. She's also my co-author for the book that we have coming out, Percolate. Let Your Best Self Filter Through. It is due out August 2013 from Hay House. We're so excited and proud. I just turned in the final manuscript, not the final manuscript, but the manuscript to be edited yesterday. So as you can imagine, the past few weeks have been crazy with finishing that up. But we're so proud to be associated with Hay House. We thank everyone at Hay House and Blog Talk Radio for just supporting us and making our show and our book and everything as successful as it can be. So with that said, here's another author coming on board here to the Best Ever You Show. We are so honored to have Luann Robinson-Hull with us. Hi, Luann. How are you today?
Hi, Elizabeth. I'm great. I'm out here in Colorado where the sun's shining and the snow's sparkling, so it's a very Christmassy time of year.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah, I love Colorado. I'm here in Maine, and it is not so, the sun's shining, but we have no snow. Can you believe it? It is December 13th, and this might be the first year I've been here where we have no snow right now. So,
I'll send a little your way. I think there's some blowing in that direction.
No, I'm good.
Okay.
Sometimes it gets to be, gets to be later on in the winter, and you're like, okay, where's the snow? And you're like, oh, and then it snows, and then you're like, oh. So, we're good. We're good for now. But anyway, you have so much about you. I don't even know where to begin. Should I begin with your book? Should I do a background? I'm just so honored to have you with us today. You've got just so much. You have a doctorate in ministry. You've got a master's degree and specialty license in clinical social work, which you've been doing for 25 years. On and on and on. How cool.
Uh-oh, that sort of ages me a little bit.
No, I don't mean on and on and on like that. We're not aging on the show. Thank you very much. This is the Best Ever You Show.
Good.
We're timeless. but how cool. What I want to ask you is, at what point did you say, this is what I'm going to do? I'm going to get a doctorate in this and a master's degree in this. Was there something in your life that moved you in that direction?
Well, Elizabeth, I think all of those of us who are in the healing profession have personal issues that cause us to go there, and so I'm certainly no exception. I was really interested in my own exploration, and that's what motivated me, and also to want to help other people, other women in particular. So I started out with clinical social work and was in the psychiatric field for a number of years, and what I found was, while I could see that there was a lot going on there in terms of certainly getting people stabilized, getting them to neutral, there was little emphasis on happiness, on loving relationships. It's just more about functioning. And so the medical model certainly is helpful in many instances, particularly in acute circumstances. Though in terms of growth and spiritual direction, I really felt like I wanted more. So I made some exploration and found Matthew Fox, who is a Dominican was a former Dominican priest and now an Episcopal priest who has really been focusing on these issues of personal growth and from a spiritual perspective. Mm-hmm. So my interests went from the clinical world to the spiritual world and now to more into brain research. And cool. So it's been an interesting ride for sure.
Well, I've got your book sitting here in front of me, and seldom do people write me handwritten notes here and there, but we're so emailish. So I just want to thank you for the wonderful handwritten note that came with your book. It was very sweet. And her book is called Happily Ever After Right Now. It is a 2011 New York Book Festival Award winner. I can't even imagine the competition in a New York Book Festival. That must be crazy. And the tagline is Stop Searching and Start Celebrating. I'm wondering what made you write the book. I think you have written several books, but what made you write this book in particular?
Well, Elizabeth, this was actually part of a dissertation project in my doctorate, and it started out with a paper that I wrote in the beginning of that undertaking. And the paper was The Myth of Prince Charming. And while I was in clinical practice, most of the people I saw were women, and most of the women that I saw were depressed and unhappy in their relationships. And I also had my own issues and felt like as much as I had studied and explored that there are the topic of misery in human relationships and in particular need-based codependent relationships was something of great interest to me, and I felt that I wanted to explore. So that's
stop you right there for one second, if I can. I'm going to interrupt you because not everybody listening to our show might know what a need-based codependent relationship is. And so I'm wondering if I could stop you there for just one second and have you explain that, because we have a lot of people who follow Best Ever You as they're just getting started in their journey of change and so forth. And so I just want to make sure any not everybody knows what that means. Do you mind doing that for me?
Absolutely. And I really don't all the way understand it myself.
That's okay.
So, I think that it's just an ongoing question for me and a subject of great curiosity. I guess I want to just talk about the origin of our insecurity. And that's really the place that I began, is where did this start? And so this is where some of the brain research comes in. And that has to do with our conditioning. Patterns that are really established in our DNA or in our ancestry that are really wired in us when we come into this life form. And so, for many of us, it may just be about understanding some of our biology. Back in the days of our earliest ancestry, a woman needed a man to protect her from the dangers of her environment. She would really be at great peril without a man. And a man needed a woman to keep the campfires going and to furnish him with a womb to complete the procreation cycle. And so I really believe that in the grand scheme of things, the universe is about 14 billion years old, our human heritage is really very young. And so we're not that old comparatively to the rest of the universe and its existence. And I think that while we have definitely evolved, we haven't really emancipated from that need-based paradigm, which is, you know, the man taking care of the woman in certain ways and her also in kind taking care of him. There's this reciprocity of need. And so what I believe the term codependency is about is that there is it involves a need-based foundation in relationships that causes each person in the relationship to be dependent on the other one, so hence codependent. What I believe we can move toward as we look into the possibility of a new paradigm in relationship is emancipating beyond that need-based pattern, because most of us really don't have those issues anymore. The woolly mammoth isn't hovering. The saber-toothed tiger isn't hanging out the door.
T-Rex is peeking in the cave.
Exactly. And so, you know, our early conditioning, while there to protect us, is really over-functioning in our brains. And what we have to do is to find some kind of balance to calm our nervous system and help it to recognize that we're not in those states of peril anymore and that we do have different options than we had early on. So I don't know, that's a pretty lengthy explanation. Does that make sense?
Sure. I think anybody listening, I think that would make absolute sense. Whether or not they completely agree with it or not, you know, it's another story or whatever. But yeah, I think in general, it totally makes sense, and people get where you're coming from. In the book, let's go back to the book, because I know I interrupted you, and I'm sorry about that, but I just want to make sure we covered, you know, if there were terms thrown out that we covered what they were. Okay, so you've written this great book, Happily Ever After Right Now, and I've been thumbing through it as I've been talking to you, and yes, I've read it already, but I always do this when I have guests on the show. I kind of casually open the book and just turn to a chapter, and I turn to chapter 2. Lucky for you, because I think you'll like this. Magnificence, choose to be queen. I was just wondering if you would talk to us a little bit about that chapter and maybe why you wrote it and what it's all about, because everybody wants to be queen.
Yes, well, I think there's a lot about princesses, you know, and I think there's, you know, what I wanted to offer in this writing was the possibility that we could move beyond that. I think that in some ways, the large mass consciousness for women, and, you know, I just want to say that, you know, I have two sons. I've even had male dogs. I have a brother. I have a lot of men in my life, and I really honor and uphold that gender and believe that they have their own struggles. So I want to establish early on that I don't have any power issues around, you know, women over men or that kind of thing. I just think that, you know, women.
On the show.
That's right.
No man bashing. I get it.
Yeah,
I can feel you tiptoeing around it. You know, I get it when you say, you know, we don't need men anymore like we used to, you know, that kind of thing. It could come off as man bashing. We're not saying that. We're just trying to make sure that women feel empowered in their own right.
That's it. That's exactly it. And I think that, and the other thing is I have a very loving partner in my life who I respect and I'm grateful for every day because he teaches me so much about myself. So all that said, what I mean by, you know, step into your queenly nature or step into your magnificence is to really the thesis of the book is really about this, and that is to recognize your own gifts, your own strengths, your own talents, the thing that is unique about you that you came into this life form to offer and to share, and that in doing that, in really putting the focus on you, what comes to pass without any exceptions that I have seen is your full-on radiance, your emanating love, your stepping into your queenly nature, your shining your light out into the world in such a way that you attract all the people, all the places, all the circumstances, all the events, and all the situations that are most going to exaggerate your queenly nature. So it's not about you going out and searching and finding and grabbing something. It's about you stepping into and becoming all of those things that you think you might find in another, and that when you do that, the natural order of things will be that you will be supplied in kind, in reciprocity, with all of those things back toward you in really abundant supply. Yeah. And so that's the idea of stepping into your magnificence, stepping into your queenly nature, not expecting someone else to do it for you, which is really the paradigm that we have been living in this need-based foundational thought form.
Right. Now, that really kind of goes for both genders. I don't know if we want to tell men to go step out into their queenly nature, but it does really apply to both, because both sets of people really need to find their light, find their love, find their compassion, find what motivates them, drives them, and in all the things that you're saying. Would you agree with that?
Oh yes, absolutely. And so yes, it does. There's this reciprocity of spirit, and women can take leadership to offer that energy. And you know, I think men are tremendously relieved when women step up to the plate and decide that they're going to come forward and offer what they have to share. And I'm not saying you have to be, I mean, of course, Elizabeth, you set an amazing role model for all of us. It's incredible what you've been able to accomplish in your life. You're a CEO, you have this very popular radio show, you're doing so many things, you're writing a book and you're being published by Hay House. This is all incredible. And each woman has her own strengths and capabilities. I mean, it could be, you know, you might be a stay-at-home mom, you might not have a career, but you would have interests and things that you would be engaged in. So
that's what Best Ever You is, you know, because I have four boys, and they're now 11, 13, 15, and 17, and I've been at home with them since they were born, and really Best Ever You was kind of born from that. When the littlest one went to first grade. And so, I mean, I completely get what you're saying. I want to ask you, when you were saying at the beginning of the show, you see and hear from a lot of women who are just, ugh, they don't feel good. They're stuck. They're stuck in their relationships. They're stuck in, you know, they might be feeling like they're stuck at home and don't have a career anymore or something. I remember feeling kind of like that, going, God, what am I going to do? I've been home for so long. I have no skills. That type of thing. If someone were to approach you and say, what's my first step, what would you say to them?
Well, the first step is to be radically honest with yourself. And I think that is very challenging.
It is hard, isn't it?
particularly in Western culture, because we've been trained to go around our pain, to do anything we can to avoid feeling as bad as we feel.
Or present like that perfect front, you know, like everything's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's really about doing the work of getting in touch with your authentic nature. What's really going on? And, you know, just letting yourself stay there, even for a nanosecond longer than you think you can. If you're stuck, if you're feeling distressed, if you're feeling desperate, whatever's going on, if you can just let yourself get radically honest for, as I said, even a nanosecond longer than you think you can stand it, you'll be amazed at the accumulation of nanoseconds that you can have to help yourself really begin to recognize, wow, I think I can really stay here. I think I can really love myself enough to just see what's going on. So the first thing is to recognize that you might be in pain and to stay there for a minute and to really see.
And you might not like that very much. That's uncomfortable, isn't it?
Pretty uncomfortable. I'm sure you've been in that place. I definitely have.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, I have a lot of anxiety, Elizabeth, and so that's certainly one of my reasons for curiosity around human behavior and what goes on in this head of mine. So, yeah, it can be very anxiety-producing.
Tell me what you mean by that. What do you mean by anxiety-producing? And just tell us a little bit about you for a minute, because there are a lot of people with anxiety, stress, you know, all that stuff. What does I interviewed Robin Mead, and she was on the cover of our magazine, and she said she would have panic attacks live on air. I mean, complete and total anxiety attacks.
Yeah, I think that, well, first of all, we have our wiring, our conditioning, the patterning, our genetic history, the way in which we come in. Fortunately, there have been studies now by cutting-edge scientists, one of whom is Bruce Lipton, that show that we can actually alter our genetics by changing our thoughts. And there's definitely empirical evidence to show that this can happen. And I'm a living example. Although I'm a work in progress, I'm my own best research project.
Y'all are.
It doesn't always work.
Sure.
But what I mean by anxiety is, you know, when things get out of whack proportionate to what's really going on. I mean, mm-hmm. you might have, I live in the mountains of Colorado, and I've always been anxious about getting off the ski lift. I mean, I always think I'm going to fall and crash and burn and something bad's going to happen. And of all the years I've been skiing, I have only fallen one time off the ski lift, and I did get whacked in the head by a chairlift. It was very uncomfortable, but I did not die. Nothing really awful happened. And so it's really a state of anticipatory stress, a state of, you mentioned there could be even panic that can come in, and it's usually disproportionate to what's going on. So, and our wiring is a mystery, as well as our environment, the conditions that cause us to be patterned in a certain direction based on our history. It's all kind of this stew pot of and this quagmire of wiring in our heads that we probably will never really understand. So there are, certainly are ways to cope with that. Just going back to our earlier topic of staying with our pain, one of the ways to do that is to have a practice of mind stabilization. That can be meditation, it can be yoga, it can be walking, just simply walking and being with your breath, anything that can start to help your brain stabilize, and then you can go back to that when you are in an anxious state.
Yeah, to kind of, what I've learned to do over the years that I've been on the planet is sort of know what my level of peacefulness is and know when I'm going, above that or really below that level of peacefulness that I've created for myself. So it's interesting to kind of know what sets you in one direction or sets you in another direction. And so I try and maintain a level of just kind of peacefulness. Do you have tips for people to, you said yoga, you said walking, you said, you didn't say eating chocolate, I noticed. Which is a very...
That's definitely a good one.
It can be very helpful.
Do not leave that
however.
Out, for sure.
Yeah.
Comfort food, definitely high on the list.
Yeah, although you got to watch how much you eat and balance that out with going to the gym so that you're on your peacefulness line. But anyway, somebody listening might not really... I guess being aware that you even don't feel good. How do you know when you... need help, I guess, is the question. How do you know? Because you said be uncomfortable with yourself and think about yourself and admit it and kind of like stop lying to yourself in a way. But, be comfortable with the pain and maybe sit in it for a while. But how do you know if you need to do that even?
Well, I really like your exercise of having this barometer of peacefulness. I think that is excellent. And I just wrote that down because I am learning also every day. Definitely, I'm no expert. I'm learning just like all the rest of us. So I'm in this cosmic stew pot of growth with you and all the listeners. So I think that's a really good idea to when you wake up every morning, if you can even just take 2 or 3 minutes. To check in with yourself and, find out where your equilibrium of peacefulness is. What would bring you peace? Are you feeling peaceful? if you're not feeling peaceful, what's happening, and that kind of thing. And then I think, too, one of the main things that I think is necessary in this busy culture of ours is to recognize that you might be tripping the wire into the uncomfortable zone before you, you know, can really do something to interrupt that. So I think that, you know, to really start to be self-aware is the most important thing. And that's the biggest challenge I think we have in our particular culture, because everything is so immediate. You know, the alarm clock goes off. It's time to get the kids up, time to get breakfast, time to get ready for work, time to do this, time to do that. So there's really very, very little space to check in with yourself and see what's going on. So I think the first thing is to really just, you know, no matter who you are, where you are in your spiritual practice or where you are in your level of development, check in with yourself when you wake up in the morning and just see what's, you know, how am I feeling? What's going on? What's,
yes.
And then begin to establish some ways to do that throughout the day.
Absolutely. And I think it's a, I think it's a really good thing to do, and you have to kind of, I don't know if age contributes to, some people are born peaceful and they just know what makes them peaceful or not, and some of us have to learn it over time. You know, some you learn it as you go. That's, oh, that didn't make me very peaceful, that made me happy, that made me sad, you know, kind of thing. And as you go through experiences, you sort of figure out what those things are. And you know, at 43 years old right now, I can pretty much tell you what makes me peaceful or not. You know, and but, you know, I'm still learning as I go, too, because I'll encounter something new and lump it into the not-so-peaceful category or the one that keeps me forward kind of thing. Does that make sense? Do you have anything to add to that?
Yes, and it makes perfect sense, Elizabeth, and the fact that you have been able to do that, I would imagine, the reason why is because you've had the will and the determination. I once had a teacher who said it requires an amazing amount of obedience and discipline to stay on this path of growth. And, you know, the mind, really wants to do anything but be disciplined. Many people call it the monkey mind. You know, it jumps all over the place. It wants immediate gratification. It wants the chocolate. It wants the croissant. By the way, that's my weakness is croissant.
Well, you know, I kind of have a theory that if I'm going to go out of control, I'm going to do it really, really well. So
exactly. I like that.
I'd be the
wonderful.
You know, well, it's scary if you've got any kind of behavior that isn't so great, you know, if I'm going to have behavior that's not so great, I'm going to be really good at that behavior too. So, you know, you got to watch it. And that you kind of learn, you kind of learn that as you grow up. You go, oh boy, I'm in college here. I better not drink that again, or I better not, you know, whatever. Do you know what I mean? You learn as you go.
Yes. And I'm older than you quite by a number of years, although I'm not going to reveal that at this time. How many years? Your first hangover that you get when you're in college from drinking whatever was in that cookie jar of hard alcohol that somebody stirred up, you definitely remember that you may not want to do that again to quite that degree. So,
and some people
do it again, though, and again.
And again, or whatever. You know, I'm just using that as an example. I in my age, I don't drink, I don't smoke, I don't, you know, I'm so boring, it's scary. But I, you know, I do know what it means, though. Like, if, you know, I'm a great chocolate eater.
And you don't smoke, but you do eat chocolate, so I'm happy to know you're having some fun.
Yeah. But, you know, I'm one of the great all-time consumers of chocolate. And about a year ago, I'm like, you know, I better not do this to myself. I'm eating so much chocolate. My head's in the bag every time something goes wrong kind of thing. And so I've kind of stepped off the chocolate party, too. And, you know, it's just interesting, though, how we have behaviors that just we sometimes do, but they aren't contributing to peace. They're not in that peaceful zone. They're below it.
No, I think the eating of chocolate and that, you know, and I just had a handful of M&Ms last night, so I know exactly what you're talking about, leftover from the movies.
Grateful
I didn't consume the whole bag at the movie. It was one of those big bag things that you buy at the movie, and, you know, it said 3 servings, so I tried to avoid eating that whole entire bag. Which the movie is,
if you ate it fast enough, it doesn't count.
What's that? Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you so much. I'll try to remember that the next time.
Yeah.
I mentioned that the movie was Lincoln, which, I know this. Yeah, it was so amazing about, someone really, really coming into this life form and offering with, selflessly the talents and gifts and heart to the most extreme measure. And so he was definitely an example, but definitely if you look at his face, if you see that movie, an example of someone who took nothing for himself. And so I think in finding that balance in talking about, chocolate, I think, or drinking or any kind of behavior that causes some kind of pleasure in the immediate, well, usually at the other end of that, there will be some pain. I mean, if we have a lot of sugar, there's going to be a spike in our, blood sugar, and then that's going to drop and, all that sort of thing, regrettably. So I think what we really want to look at, and Scott Peck, by the way, was one of the great all-time philosophers, in my view. He wrote The Road Less Traveled, and I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but he's been gone for many years, but just really contributed to my life with some of his phrases. And one of them, I think, which has become quite popular, is immediate gratification.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard of that?
Yeah, instant gratification.
Instant immediate. So he's really the one, I think, that coined that phrase back in 1978. So I think anything that you do that causes immediate relief that might interrupt your ability to go deeper into what's going on is probably not going to be the solution.
Yeah, I think that's a really safe statement.
Something always happens
to do something like that. Whether it's I totally get what you mean. Let me see what time it is here. It's we're about at the halfway mark, and I just want to remind everybody who's just joining us that we're having a chat with Luann Robinson Hull, and her book is called Happily Ever After Right Now, Stop Searching and Start Celebrating. It's available wherever books are sold. If you don't see it right there in the bookstore, make sure and ask for it, or you can go on to Amazon, or you can go on to Luann's website, which is spelled Luann Robinsonhull.com. So Luann Robinson Hull. You also have a blog, whatagem.wordpress.com. I'm going to have you talk about that in a minute. You're on Facebook at Happily Ever After Right Now, and you can follow her. There's a lot of information right here. You can follow her on Twitter at Luann R. Hull. So I'll make sure you're also on YouTube. So, you can Google around Luann Robinson Hull. How many books have you written?
Well, Happily was my first book.
Okay.
So I'm writing my second book now called Self-Belonging, which is a further examination of what goes on in our heads and hopefully some practical applications for how to ameliorate some of the challenges. And so it's been really fun, and I'm enjoying working with some of the brain researchers and again, being my own best research project. it's been really fun. I've been researching this book since January, so I know you're a writer too, Elizabeth, and we have these grandiose ideas about how soon we think these things are going to be finished, and I thought this one was going to go really quickly, but I have a sense it may not be out till next year, so we'll see how that goes, but it's been a great ride.
Yeah, I suppose when you've actually got a doctorate and all that stuff, you're in more research mode than fiction writing. So that's probably a little bit more detailed and probably a lot of work, I'm guessing.
Well, I think they're both very challenging. I think fiction writing involves a lot of creativity and is a whole other skill set. and requires, you know, great talent. So I have tremendous admiration for people who write fiction, and I would love to get into that at some point.
So, looks like you're a pretty great poet. I'm looking in your book here, and you've written The Sacred Cell. So I think you do write not just research type stuff. Do you dabble in poetry a little bit?
I do. I think, you know, the poetry is interesting. It is very, for me, it's not predictable, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes it'll be prolific, and sometimes, you know, I can sit there with a pen in hand or right in front of the computer and nothing happens. I find that, not unlike what I say in my book, everything comes from inspiration, right? So when you get an inspiration, or when I get an inspiration, and that poem was written for the man that I love, who I, you know, have known now for 10 years. That was when we first met. And it has to do with a conversation that we had about, you know, the very topic that we talked about early on, which was cave dwelling and how people behaved in early relationships, and maybe we're primed and ready to emancipate from that. And that's really what that poem is about. So that's why it felt like a good fit for the opening chapter of the book.
Yeah, it's absolutely beautiful. I mean, absolutely beautiful. So yeah, you're a very just outstanding writer. It's an exciting process. It's exciting to hear you say that you're going to come out with another book, because it's really hard to write a book. It kind of takes years. Some of the stuff that, doesn't it? It's just hard.
Oh my gosh, yes. It took me 10 years to finish happily. I mean, altogether, I did the dissertation and, you know, all throughout my doctoral program, which was about 6 years, and that was finished. But then to morph it into the book that it became for public use, it took another 4 years and, you know, various different agents and all you know the journey. It's been really fascinating. One of rejection, one of acceptance, one of I like this, I don't like this, you know.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, it's a process.
Definitely a process. I have just an author question for you. After you put a book out like this, let's just say, do you open it up and it's in print and everything, and you go, oh, I should have changed that word. There's a thing going on with me right now where I'm like trying to get it so that I wouldn't change a word of it. And I'm guessing that's not going to be what really happens.
No, it's never finished.
It's going to frustrate me.
No, I mean, it's, you know, because in writing, I don't know if you, you know, I don't want to digress here too much with that, but, you know, just for people who might be listening that are writers, you know, you can write something, you can set it down. This I find to be true, I know, with self-belonging. I started it in January, and I actually set it aside for a couple of months, and I picked it back up again, and I've been reading it, and I'm thinking, oh, my gosh, did I really write this? And I need to change that. I need to, you know, it's like, because when you, after the first week or two, you tweak it a little bit, and you think, huh, that's pretty good. I'm pretty awesome.
And then you're like, oh no,
I can't believe I wrote that. So yes, it's, and then I go back and happily, which now is, you know, it's been published. It was published in 2010. So yes, in fact, I am now working on getting the ebook finalized for the book, and I'm having to go back through it again. And, you know, seeing all these, and I'm thinking, I'm really tempted to make changes. So, yeah, you know. But one of the things that I encourage you to do is to enter these contests, because I did enter the New York one, and then I also entered the New England one, which I won last January. So, you know, if you can get, and then if you have a wonderful publisher, so if people believe in you a little bit, it can help you with that. You know, that little twinge of, I need to change this, I need to change that, and just let it go, you know.
Sure.
So somewhere.
Yeah. I get it completely. Yeah, I totally get it. Thank you for that, because I think there are a lot of, I was wondering, but also, you know, we have a lot of people that follow us that are in that mode of writing books and things like that. I'm sure there are some of your colleagues even listening who want to write a book and haven't done it or whatever, you know, there's all different types of people out there. And I do want to talk about this for a minute. Speaking of being creative or writing or wanting to do something different or changing or, you know, all the things that we've been talking about on the show, and that's the moment of now. What's now versus the past versus the future? How important is these moments right here, right now to you or to people?
Well, you know, I think in this time frame, wherever anyone is who is listening, there's a lot of hype about, you know, December 21st, 2012, that, you know.
All dying and all this stuff, yeah.
Yeah, and so we have a very strong New Age emphasis that is really brewing and brimming in our culture that talks about being the present, being the now. What does that mean exactly? I mean, in a practical sense, because the mind wants to be anywhere but now, right? We're in the past, we're in the future, we're in anticipation, we're in regret. And so what I have found, Elizabeth, and I would imagine you might agree with me, is that if it's possible for me to really just stay here, like, you know, looking out at the snow dripping off the tree or just being available for this conversation, that I'm going to have a lot more fun in life. If I start going into the future, if I start going into the past, there's a chance for me to really get tripwired and to get off center. So I think, you know, it's a really practical application of your life. I mean, it's for me, it's not about the New Agey, you know, oh, I'm just going to hang out and breathe or something. It's yeah. really...
Just to hang out and breathe. Breathe
yeah.
or breathe.
Yeah.
I'm going to hang out and breathe. That's what I'm going to do today. I'm going to hang
right.
out and breathe. You know, one of the best examples of right here and right now is actually being on the radio or doing a live interview, because there's no way we could be on the radio together right now and be actually talking and thinking, well, what am I going to have for dinner? What am I going to do tomorrow? What am I going to, you know, it would have to like be vocalized, or you would come off like you're not listening, or I would come off like I'm not listening. Isn't it interesting? I think live anything is a perfect example of now.
That is so true. And that's exactly what I was going to say, that you're being 100% available for me on this conversation. That's what's
you
making
are for
this
me.
Work.
Yeah,
thank
it's a
you.
Chat. Yeah, no, it's wonderful, but it's a really good example. And people think about living in the now. It's like, well, it means being present, sort of, and being more so like listening to other people or being available to them or whatever. And it could be just as simple as that. I don't know if I have every answer for that one either, but I know it's not sitting on the phone with you right now and thinking, gosh, I wish I wouldn't have done that yesterday, because I'd be quiet. You know what I mean? There's no
yeah.
way I can do both. You know, I want to get back to also, you're really a relationships expert as well. And I really want to point that out to people. I know we've been talking about a lot of different topics because you're very fascinating to speak with, and I love your book. But if you were to say one thing about you, do you think it's that you help people with their relationships? Do I have that right?
Yes. That's my area of focus and my area of interest, because I think it's the most important topic in our world is human relationships, human connection. And so, yes, that's my area of, I'm going to say, growing expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm constantly learning. But, yes, that's my emphasis.
If I have a divorce, which I do, does that mean I'm crappy at relationships?
No, I'm divorced, and I've actually never remarried, and I've had, a number of relationships since my divorce. I've been divorced since 1986. And so am I crappy at relationships? No one is crappy at relationships. We all just do the best that we can based on our history, based on our resources, based on our skill set. So the fact that you are having a conversation with me about these topics tells me that you are in a place of growth and in a desire and in a place of, openness with your heart to the possibility of how you can develop. So the relationships, John Wellwood said this. He's an Eastern philosopher who I really love. He wrote Perfect Love, Imperfect Relationships. And he says that relationships, and this is not a very, pretty metaphor, but he says that intimate relationships are the charnel ground where we really can come to know about ourselves. And the charnel ground in the East, this is not a pretty picture, but just to be explicit, is a place where people take dead bodies to be burned. And so it's, a place where vultures come. And, it's really kind of an ugly, a very displeasing environment. So things, can get really, really difficult and challenging when we go into the depth of what's happening in our intimate relationships, just because of the way we're wired. So
I've been remarried for 14 years now, and I think my husband and I were just talking about this the other day. I'm like, what do you think it is, the secret to being able to stay married for so long? And I personally think that it is the ability to change with the other person. As they change, you change. As you change, they change, and you grow together. Because when you get married and you're 28 years old, like I was for the second time, I'm a whole different person. I'm still there, but I've changed so much at age 43, from going from 28 to 43. And we've
that
been able
is, that's
but it's changed.
Sorry.
I mean, you can interrupt. It's our show. We can interrupt each other. It's fun. It makes the conversation flow. Go ahead.
Well, that is absolutely correct, and I would actually add to that and say adapt. And one of the things that I'm really very adamant about, and I try not to use strong words, but I really do feel strongly about this particular idea. There's a difference between compromise and negotiation. In negotiation, everyone wins. Because you come together, you process your thoughts, your differences, and you negotiate an outcome that will cause the relationship to expand. Yes, both of you will have to give something, but in the long run, when you do so, you will each benefit. In compromise, there is a threat of codependency, and by that I mean you do this because you worry that if you don't, the other person might leave you, might be upset, but that there's, and that when you do make this compromise, there's an underlying resentment, and that can build. So, yes, the whole success of the relationship, I believe, is based on your ability together as a couple or as a nation to be able to negotiate an outcome that will be more favorable. For both, or in the case of a nation, for the good of the whole, then otherwise would have happened if you wouldn't have made that negotiation, and that you would just have gone on, and then things would fall apart eventually. So yes, it's adapting to the other person, but it's also recognizing that when you do so, you're not compromising, you're benefiting, and that's really an important piece to it.
Yeah. I look at my parents, and they've been married for 40 some years now, and I don't think they ever thought they were going to have a lot of the health problems that they have. They're almost 70 now, and that, just looking at their relationship from afar, is almost sort of fascinating in how they maneuvered through life together. It's absolutely fascinating, because I swear to God, with 11 kids, they've had everything thrown at them. They have like 11, I'd have to stop and count, but I think there's 11 kids and like 17 grandkids, and my dad's a stroke survivor, and there's a ton of things. And I look at that and I think, boy, it would really have been easy to give up a long time ago.
Yeah, they are. Well, I think it would be great to... So definitely a regret that I have with my parents that I didn't spend more time asking questions and taking notes.
My book has a lot of it. My book Percolate has a lot of stuff in it, yeah.
That's so great, because what a perfect mentoring for your public to take your own life and questions, you know, and answers from your family of origin to share with other people about their successes. And 11 children, wow, that is amazing.
Kind of a, you know, it, and I think a lot of times people get married and they think they're in a movie or something. I don't know what quite, I know I did. The first time I got married, I'm thinking, fantasy land, you know. Somebody, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than that, relationships. It's not just like it happens in a movie.
Yes, they're very complicated. And the deeper you go, the more complicated it becomes, which is kind of the bad news. The good news is, and that, you know, relates to the charnel ground piece, the good news is that you can really benefit from the compost that happens from that charnel ground. I mean, you can, you know, if you grind it all up and dump it in the earth, something really green and beautiful can grow from that. But you have to be willing to, you know, to dive in there and dig. And sometimes it's not pretty, and sometimes it's not easy, and sometimes getting to that negotiation table can be very challenging. And that goes back, Elizabeth, to the most original statement that we made about the queen and the magnificence. It really requires of us to, not in a controlling kind of domineering sort of way, like we talked about earlier, but in a really loving and empowered way, to stand tall like your own Statue of Liberty, and in a loving way, support yourself in having confidence to recognize that, you know, you deserve to have joy and love and support and respect and, you know, to be cherished and all of those things. And that when you really can hold yourself in that place, you can come from a much stronger position in your negotiating table than if you were thinking, oh, I don't deserve this, or I'm afraid, or what if he's going to leave, or all that sort of thing. So right. The really fundamental way in which you can offer your best is to be that queen, that magnificent person that all of those of you are, women who are listening, and then, or the king, the men too.
So we have 10 minutes left in that. I'm going to open a can of worms and just ask you this question. Do you, two questions actually. Do you believe that you have to love yourself thoroughly through and through, know yourself, know who you are, et cetera, to be in any kind of successful relationship? That's the first one. And the second one is that the thinking of, no one's ever going to love me. Here's my suitcase full of junk that I bring to the party. Who would ever accept me with all this crap?
Mm-hmm. Good. There's a social worker by the name of Brené Brown, and she has done significant research into the subject of love and what she calls wholeheartedness. And so I wanted to bring her study into the into the final answer. The first part of the question is, do you have to love yourself to be able to have a loving relationship? And the answer to that question for me is unequivocally yes. How to do that is complex.
Isn't it?
Because, you know, particularly as women, the archetype, which is a Carl Jung term, Carl Gustav Jung, who was a psychologist in the late 1800s and very influential and from a spiritual standpoint to the modern psychology, added to Freud's, definitely, you know, contributed to Freud's work, but brought in a spiritual component. Use that word archetype, which is a term that means primary influence. In other words, you know, the primary theme of women still in our culture is nurturing, loving, giving, supporting, that kind of thing. And so while we're good at that, we also have to shift into balancing how we can do that and become that for ourselves. It's not necessarily still emphasized in our culture. So we don't have a lot of time to go over that topic. Women can explore that in their own ways. They have their.
It means look in the mirror and say, I love you, instead of, God, my butt's big.
Yeah, or like, you know, I can't stand this wrinkle, or I have bags under my eyes or whatever. So
it goes
definitely
on
and emphasize
anything like that. Any of that negative chatter where you look in the mirror and go, oh, my God, I'm so old. I got wrinkles. My hair, all that stuff. That's unloving behavior. And so it's better, interrupt me here, but it's better if you say, I love myself. Here I am, and, you know, here I am, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's hard because the voices are going to come back in to discourage you. And so,
sure.
Yes, it's definitely a starting point, looking in the mirror, say, I love you, and then find any way throughout your day that you can support yourself in doing that. You know, remember things or make a list.
How about that suitcase we carry with us of all the things that we think negatively about ourselves or that's happened to us, or, you know, thinking like of somebody who's been divorced twice, let's just say, and they're thinking about getting into a new relationship with somebody. Well, at some point they have to say, well, you know, I've been divorced twice, and the other person's going to go, you have? I wonder why. Oh, my God, you know, kind of thing. And there's that whole sort of almost like judgment, is somebody going to like me, suitcasey thing going on with relationships.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, your head is going to try to persuade you to the negative. so, you know, just be aware that self-love is the very first thing that has to happen for you to have a successful relationship. And so definitely, definitely, extremely good and important and valid point for this conversation, if not the most. The second part of the question is, you know, has to do with just what you said, can anybody love me? Am I, you know, all these things have happened. And to recognize in our human family that we're all vulnerable. And to the extent that you can stand in your place of self-love, you can allow your vulnerabilities to be more openly exposed. So
that's a good,
you know,
point right there. I love that.
Yeah.
And if somebody loves you, they're going to love everything about you. And they help you grow, change, and learn, and deal, and cope, and all those things, right?
Yes, absolutely. And so in your willingness to stand in your vulnerabilities, of which we all have many, and definitely I have my own, you know, very impressive collection, my own bag full. In fact, I'm sitting here looking at my suitcase. I'm thinking, oh, my God, that thing could be really heavy. So this is what Brené Brown found, that the people who had the most success in loving relationships, whom she called wholehearted people, and this is a longitudinal study, that means a study done over time, for 10 years, she found that those who were the most successful, again, wholehearted people, she termed, were the ones who could say, I love you first, without guarantee of what they were going to get in return, exposing their most challenging areas of rawness and vulnerability. So it's like, wow, I have these warts and these pumps and, you know, these bruises. I have these little fat things on my thighs or in bags under my eyes, and, you know, but I'm still me, and I'm still standing here naked loving you. So, but the first step is, and it's completely important what you brought to our awareness, is that self-love piece, because without that, you can't really be vulnerable with another person. You have to hide the things that you think would be those warts and those pimples. So
I can't believe
I, you know.
We're out of time. We've got 1 minute to wind this up. How are we're going to wind it up with peace, self-love, all the things we've been talking about. But let me just come back here so we don't cut off live here, and just let everybody know about your websites and book one more time. And just thank you for being with us first. I love chatting with you.
Thank you. So great.
Yeah, I hope you'll come back again. And everybody, I don't have an applause button, but thank you, Luann Robinson Hall. And please visit her website at Luann Robinson Hall. She's on Facebook and Twitter at Luann R. Hall. And her book is Happily Ever After Right Now, Stop Searching and Start Celebrating, which is what we're going to do. So thank you, Luann. I appreciate you being with us today. I hope you come back because we're just getting started. An hour's not long enough.
Oh, Elizabeth, it's been a great honor, and thank you so much for the terrific work that you're doing. I really just feel so privileged to have been a guest. So
thank you.
Deep appreciation to you.
Yep, and congratulations on your award-winning book, and good luck with the next one. So, all right, everybody, take care, and I'm looking in my calendar for who we have next. I'm going to make noise here. We have Dr. Margaret Paul coming up on the 18th. All right, thanks, everybody. Have a great day. Bye, Luann.
Bye. Thanks, Elizabeth.
Thanks for listening to the Best Ever You Show. Want more? Visit us at besteveryou.com. Be your best and keep it real. Confident, successful, caring, and beautiful every day with Best Ever You.